welcome back
to Behind the Crime.
I'm Rebecca Wood.
And I'm Ella Calora.
And we're your hosts. This is our 23rd episode.
That's crazy.
That's older than us.
Yeah. And as you might see before or after this episode goes out, we're going to start some little videos, which is why I feel really awkward right now because
I don't know where to look.
Yeah, I don't know if I should be looking at a camera. I feel like that camera, you can't even see me.
We're going to start doing this with every episode, hoping to have at least 3 clips for YouTube Reels and probably putting it on Instagram as well.
Yeah.
I don't know. Should we get a TikTok? Stay tuned for more clips to come out. If you're just listening, then you should go to our Instagram and our YouTube and our TikTok. We don't have one right now, but we will let you know what the username is when we do have one.
Yeah.
It'll be some variation of Behind the Crime.
Behind the Crime.
Okay. Well, no. In this episode, we decided to focus on cases that involved poison. What's funny? Poison's funny to you?
No, I need to say I will be eating french fries for the first half of this episode. I'm starving.
I'm not. I ate some dip last night, and then I literally thought I was going to throw up and pass out, and I didn't know what to do, and I just was shaking. I'm recovering, though.
I was sleeping while this was going on.
She was sleeping. And I accidentally, I ran out of the room because I thought I was going to throw up right then and there. And I just did not close the door behind me. I'm so sorry. Everyone could have seen you sleeping.
That's creepy.
Okay. Well, I'm going first so that Ella can finish her meal. Oh, while she dances. She's dancing.
I just came from dance too. So I'm like.
No, we don't like those sounds that you're making. I speak for the audience. They don't like it. So, my case does take place in China, and I did look up the pronunciation for a lot of these names. So, if they're wrong, it's Google's fault and not mine. Because I did watch, videos to make sure I was pronouncing things right, because I don't want to be pronouncing our literal victim's name incorrectly, you know?
Yeah. You tried. You did your research.
Yeah. So, this is the case of Zhu Ling. I'm just going to talk about her a little bit before I get into what happened to her. She was born on April 24th in 1973. And in 1994, she was a sophomore at Tsinghua University in Beijing, China. And she was a physical chemistry major. So she was also...
Physical chemistry, you said?
Yes, physical chemistry.
Okay.
Something to do with chemistry. I don't know either. Her classmates and friends described her as attractive, intelligent, talented, and musically inclined. And she had a lot of interest in music. She was in her university orchestra, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So I'm kind of just going to get into the beginning of the symptoms that she started facing. Stop dancing while I'm talking about this poor girl.
I'm sorry. I'm wound up right now.
Well, wind it down. So on November 24th, 1994, she began to have unusual and debilitating symptoms. She reported having abdominal pain and a loss of appetite. And then again on December 5th, 1994, same year, she started experiencing more abdominal discomfort and started to lose her hair. Then December 11th, same year, we're all still in 1994, she had a performance that night with her college orchestra that I mentioned before at the Beijing Concert Hall, and she insisted on performing, she didn't want to miss this because she just loved being in the orchestra so much, but she had to wear glasses during it because of eye pain, and at some point she was her vision essentially was going in and out. So at some point she could see literally nothing. At other points it was just a little fuzzy. At other points it was fine. A few days after the performance, most of her hair had fallen out. So it was very rapidly. These symptoms were happening to her very rapidly.
How old was she again?
She would have been 20.
Okay.
Going on 21. Mm-hmm. On December 23rd, she was hospitalized at Beijing Tongren Hospital. And as her condition improved, she was released on December 24th and allowed to return to school. But the semester, I believe, had already ended at this point, so she didn't return to school until February 20th, 1995, when she started a new semester.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just forget everything I said before. I misspoke or I wrote things down wrong. So soon after starting her new semester, she reported having extreme pain in both of her legs. And her condition just got worse and was continuing to experience the pain in her legs as well as a lot of dizziness. On March 6th, 1995, her parents took her to the Peking University Third Hospital. There's a lot of different hospital names that I'm going to say, so do your best to differentiate because they also have similar names, so it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
But I'll try and make it clear. So Professor Chen Zhenyang was involved in her diagnosis and treatment, and on March 8th, he wrote that Zhu Ling was suffering from intense foot and calf pains to the point where she tried not to touch anything. So it was, like, painful to the touch. So, like, if she brushed against anything, it hurt really badly. If anything touched her, it hurt really badly. But even just sitting there, it still hurt.
Oh.
But touch made it worse. And she was just rapidly getting worse, and her pain was spreading to her lower back at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So then on March 9th, 1995, so at this point she's been in the hospital for a few days, and she was taken to a neurology specialist clinic by her parents at Peking Union Medical College Hospital. So it's different than Peking University Third. It's Peking Union Medical College Hospital, which I will from now on refer to as PUMCH because that's a lot of words.
Yeah.
And that's how the article I looked at referred to it. So Professor Li Shunwei attended to Zhu Ling and told her mother that her symptoms were similar to a case of thallium poisoning that occurred in the 1960s at the same university, at Tsinghua University.
At the same university? Mm-hmm. Oh.
But they just said they were similar. They didn't really go too far into detail on that one. So then medical records from March 9th, the same day, described Zhu Ling as mentally clear and articulate, but experiencing significant hair loss, limbs hurting to the touch, redness at her fingertips and soles of her feet, which they noted were not swollen but had an increased temperature. A reduced feeling in her fingertips and below the knees, and she had a symmetric knee reflex, but her ankle reflex was slow.
Hmm.
Medical records said that they suspected poisoning such as thallium or beryllium, and they also noted that she had Mies lines on her fingernails, which I'm going to put a photo on our Instagram post, so if you look to the second slide and Facebook too, I'll include a photo of what Mies lines look like, but they are white lines of discoloration that will go across your finger or toenails, and that can be a sign of thallium poisoning. So she did have that. Then Professor Li Shunwei contacted Professor Zhang Shulin from the Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences Institute of Labor Health. Again, long name. For a second opinion, Shulin suspected that based on her symptoms, she either had thallium or arsenic poisoning, but they weren't able to conduct the needed tests to diagnose this. They said that they just had a lack of equipment. And they asked her if she had come into contact with thallium in class because she was a chemistry student, but she said she hadn't had any contact, and her professors confirmed that they hadn't done anything with thallium, so it wouldn't have made sense for her to be exposed to it at school.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on March 15th, 1995, same year, she was admitted to the neurology ward of the hospital at PUMCH. So we're back to, well, no, we've been there. Forget that. It's hard. There's so many different hospitals. So on March 16th, doctors ruled out autoimmune diseases, metabolic diseases, and poisoning. So they decided that none of those were the cause of her symptoms, and they started treat her for Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a rapid onset. I'm reading this for a quote, which is why I'm going to be staring at my paper. It is a rapid onset muscle weakness caused by the immune system damaging the peripheral nervous system, typically both sides of the body involved, which was true in her case. And the initial symptoms are changes in sensation or pain, often in the back, along with muscle weakness beginning in the feet and hands, often spreading to the arms and upper body. So she, after being admitted to the neurology ward, her condition was worsening rapidly. Like, she was just not getting any better. She wasn't saying the same. She was getting worse and worse quickly. The pain began to spread to her chest, and her facial muscles became distorted, and her speech was deteriorated because of that. They couldn't really understand what she was trying to say. Like, she was able to talk and she knew what she wanted to say, but she just couldn't get the words to come out properly. She also at this point was unable to drink even water without choking and began to have difficulty breathing. So her treatment for the Guillain-Barré syndrome included different antibiotics, antiviral drugs, steroids, immunosuppressants, and albumin injections, which is a globular protein. So they were injecting protein into her. On March 20th in 1995, she fell into a coma. And on the 23rd, while she was still in this coma, she had central respiratory failure and doctors performed a tracheectomy.
How old was she at this point? 21 or?
Almost 21, because her birthday is in April.
Okay.
So if you don't know what a tracheectomy is, it's a surgical airway management procedure which consists of making an incision on the anterior aspect, the front of the neck, and opening a direct airway through an incision in the trachea, also known as windpipe, if you don't know what your trachea is. So they performed that surgery while she was still in her coma. So the same day, they changed her diagnosis to acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, something like that. I don't know how to say it, but it's known as ADEM, which is what I'm going to call it.
Yeah.
So ADEM is a rare autoimmune disease that starts with sudden inflammation in the brain and spinal cord. And treatment for this included plasma exchange therapy, which they began on March 24th, the very next day. And they continued to have these plasma exchange sessions until April 18th. In total, she had 7 sessions, and each session included about 1,400 to 2,000 milliliters of plasma, totaling 10,000 milliliters by the end of her treatment. They believe that this treatment did play a crucial role in keeping her alive. Well, not everyone believes that, but some of her doctors think that that kept her alive, like it was crucial and they needed to do that. But during the treatment, she contracted hepatitis C.
This poor girl.
I know. And this whole time, like, it's all happening without her knowing, because she's, you know what I mean? Like, her parents are making these decisions to let, you know, which it's totally not their fault, but. Yeah. So on March 28th, she contracted pneumothorax on her left lung, which is a collection of air outside the lung itself, but still in the cavity. And this is dangerous because, this is dangerous because it could cause so much pressure on the lung that the lung could collapse. And she was already, you know, on a ventilator because she was struggling to breathe.
Yeah.
And at this point, she was moved into intensive care and remained on a ventilator. Then on April 3rd, they held a comprehensive neurology consultation where medical experts from multiple different hospitals, including PUMCH, where she is, PLA General Hospital, Beijing Hospital, and many others, a bunch of doctors just got together and talked about what was going on because they didn't really know what to do. All determined that their current diagnosis and treatment were adequate, and they agreed to explore other options, but not thallium poisoning because PUMCH had ruled it out. So
they double check your work, double check right, others' like, works, especially when it's like something this serious.
I know.
It's not like, I feel like some doctors or even like in any field, like some people don't want to double check others' works because they feel like it'll make that person feel like bad or like,
even like they don't want to check their own work again because they don't want to have been
wrong. They don't want to be wrong, they don't want to insult anyone. But when it comes especially to the medical field, double check your work because that's someone's life.
Yeah. So they conducted a bunch more tests on her, which included HIV testing, lumbar puncture, immune system evaluations. She had an MRI. They did chemical poisoning tests, anti-nuclear antibodies, nuclear antigen antibodies, tested for Lyme disease, urinary arsenic, and more than that. That's not all the tests that they did, but they didn't check further for thallium. So everything that they tested came back negative except for Lyme disease. So she did have Lyme disease, but that wasn't causing this issue. And they explicitly at this point told her family that thallium poisoning was ruled out. It was not thallium poisoning. They specifically said that.
Guys.
So now we get into an interesting part. So Zhuling's friends, Kai Chuanjing and Bei Zicheng, I'm sorry if that's wrong, were frustrated with the doctors not being able to help their friend, so they posted an SOS letter on a bunch of different internet groups on April 10th, again, still in 95, and they were just asking for help for their friend if anyone knew what it was, because clearly the doctors weren't reaching out to outside forces,
yeah,
you know,
other
doctors outside of the area, outside of the country that might have seen this before. So apparently, according to what I read, in 1995, only a few research institutes had internet connection in China. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
But
who's to say? I have no idea. But Kai's advisor did have connections, so they used her advisor's computer.
Mm-hmm.
And within hours, over 15,000 responses flooded in, and about a third of these responses said that she had thallium poisoning, even though it had been ruled out by doctors simply because she said she had no contact with it. And for future reference, the antidote for thallium poisoning is Prussian blue. That's one of two, but I'll get into that more later. A professor at the UCLA School of Medicine set up a server to store Zhuling's data, all of her medical data, and had a collection and categorization for emails received about the case from all around the world. So basically, medical experts worldwide could access the server and could submit treatment ideas and diagnoses and other suggestions. So really, people, you know, unpaid, were working to try and help figure out what was wrong with this girl.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And Dr. Robert Fink was a neurosurgeon from the United States who believed that heavy metal poisoning was highly probable, but PUMCH said that all laboratory tests related to heavy metal poisoning had been conducted. But upon further communication between Dr. Fink and her team at PUMCH, it was discovered that they had only performed screening tests for metal arsenic, not thallium. So they actually couldn't rule out thallium poisoning like they did. And doctors from St. Jude's Children's Hospital said that suspected thallium poisoning can be nearly diagnosed based on symptoms such as hair loss, gastrointestinal problems, and neurological issues. All things that Zhuling had.
One would think.
Yeah. So Dr. Fink urged her doctors at PUMCH to conduct thallium poisoning screening, but they still did not want to. On April 18th, 1995, Bei Zicheng brought the translated emails, like thousands of emails, translated to the ICU at PUMCH where her friend was, and apparently was not met with any proactive response. I think they just took the emails and did nothing with them.
Of course.
Yeah, they didn't change her diagnosis to thallium poisoning, and years later, it was revealed that the director of the ICU at PUMCH refused to conduct further tests for heavy metal poisoning. And even after it was revealed that their diagnosis was wrong, he was not remorseful for this. He was just didn't feel like he did anything wrong or could have done anything more. He also apparently said that due to the fact that the suggestions for thallium poisoning came from doctors outside of China, that the matter was an attempt by Western anti-China forces to discredit the Chinese medical community. Now, this is just about trying to help a girl,
mm-hmm.
like a young girl
just
who
trying
is
to save her life,
hanging on by a thread, mm-hmm. like still in a coma at this point.
Yeah.
So now Zhu Ling's parents learned that Professor Chen Zhenyang from the Beijing Institute of Labor Production could conduct thallium poisoning tests, and they discreetly got assistance from one doctor at PUMCH. They took some of Zhu Ling's urine, cerebrospinal fluid, blood, nails, and hair samples, and on April 28th, they brought all the samples they collected to the Beijing Institute of Labor Production, and the results were, and I quote, "all specimens showed very high levels of thallium." So
how many months after she was initially, like,
this is over a year.
Admitted to the hospital?
Because the first time she was in the hospital was December of 1994. Now we're in April of 95. So doctors have known about her condition for over a year.
And we're like, it's not
thallium
poisoning.
The thallium levels that she had were hundreds to thousands times higher than the levels in a healthy person. So, yeah. Professor Chen Zhenyang issued a report that said Zhu Ling was suffering from thallium poisoning twice. So she had been poisoned twice and suspected that it was intentional. So now I'm going to get into a little bit of an explanation of what thallium poisoning is, just so we all know what it is. Thallium poisoning is one of the most complex and serious toxicities known to man, apparently, which I didn't know until doing this research. Initial symptoms of thallium poisoning can include fever, gastrointestinal problems, delirium, convulsions, and coma. She's in a coma. It also said that symptoms might appear rapidly, but more commonly there is a gradual development of mild gastrointestinal disturbances, skin eruptions, stomatitis, atrophic changes in the skin, and nail changes, aka Mies lines, and skin hyperesthesia, which is mainly in the soles of the feet and the tibia. And this is among other symptoms that, you know, gradually develop. Other symptoms include degenerative changes in the heart, liver, and kidney, hemorrhage, bone marrow depression, and increased radiopacity of the liver may also occur. So there's also the issue of development of psychotic behavior with hallucinations and dementia. In some cases, this doesn't happen every time, but this is a possible symptom. Also, in most humans, the most characteristic sign of thallium poisoning is alopecia, which is hair loss. Mm-hmm. And it usually appears in cases when death is delayed for 15 to 20 days, meaning she had this in her system untreated for 15 to 20 days, which is why her hair fell out so quickly a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And other signs of symptoms can develop at any stage, so it doesn't matter when you were poisoned. You could develop it later if it's untreated.
Yeah.
And thallium poisoning can be contracted through air, water, food, and through skin contact, and it's most potent in food. The current therapy for thallium is the use of Prussian blue and potassium chloride, and apparently potassium therapy is the single most effective agent in the treatment of thallium poisoning, but further research is still needed to come up with the perfect antidote. So now we know that she has thallium poisoning, and now I'm going to get into PUMCH's response. On April 28th, 1995, doctors were still not going to treat her with Prussian blue, the advised medication, you know, the antidote. They were planning to give her dimercaprol, which is used to treat acute arsenic, gold, lead, and mercury poisoning.
Oh my goodness.
Not what she had. It was thallium poisoning, not mercury, not gold, not lead, not arsenic.
Just say, we were wrong.
Right? Like,
and move on.
If you now know that she has thallium poisoning.
Yeah.
What are you doing? So finally, on May 3rd, a year and 4 or 5 months after, you know, she was poisoned for the first time, they started treatment with Prussian blue. And on August 31st, she woke up from her coma that she was in for 5 months. So I'm going to talk about her recovery a little bit now. Her symptoms did begin to improve. She was able to move her upper limbs and her memory improved. She was able to express simple questions, but they were unclear about what she was saying. So her language was just not, they couldn't make out what she was saying. And she also used to play string instruments, and now she could still make the movements with her hands, but she couldn't produce any sound on the string, so she didn't have the muscle strength. Yeah. And her mouth and tongue's coordination were impaired, so she was never going to be able to speak properly again, which is why they were unclear about what she was trying to say when she was talking. She also lost a lot of her vision and had partial atrophy of her optic nerve in one eye. And her lower limbs were paralyzed forever. So it was revealed 4 months later. It was revealed later that she had 4 months of exposure to thallium, which increased dosages with increased dosages and increased frequency. So it was happening more often and in higher dosages she was giving being poisoned. And she apparently had roughly 2 weeks of constant ingestion of thallium as well as lead.
Constant as in like every day of the week or like once a week at least?
I think every day. So now I'm going to get into the police investigation a little bit. We're almost done. on April 28th, when she was finally diagnosed with thallium poisoning, her parents requested the head of the chemistry department at Tsinghua University, who was also the head of student affairs, to report the case to police. And they reported it to campus police, but not the actual police.
Well, that's not...
Yeah. And the next morning, Zhu's aunt requested that they would relocate all students living in the same dorm to preserve the scene and also seal her belongings there. But they didn't want to do that. They were like, that would be impossible. And they were like, plus, there's a holiday this weekend. So most of them were going home. So they didn't do that. And between April 18th and May 7th, there was a theft in her room. And she had several roommates, but the only items that were taken were hers. None of her roommates were missing anything. What was missing was her contact lens case, lipstick, shampoo, shower gel, and a water cup.
So
all different ways that you could come in contact with thallium.
I was about to say, so probably all of those things were poisoned. Mm-hmm. So all the evidence.
Basically, yeah.
That makes me so mad.
So on May 7th, the Beijing Municipal Public Security Bureau initiated an investigation, which was the same day that her family made a statement with police about her stolen items. They discovered that only 200 people in the area had access to thallium, and they determined that it had to be a female close to Zhu Ling because the university was strict with female dorms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly, but I have a feeling they didn't let men in them, you know, or at least not at night.
Yeah.
So I don't think any male would have been able to pull this off for so long. Police did find invoices for thallium purchases by a student who was in a research group, and her name was Sun Wei. Sun Wei became a suspect, their only suspect that they had. And apparently Sun Wei and Zhu Ling's fathers were both employed by China Earthquake Administration, but Zhu Ling's father said he didn't know Sun Wei's father. They didn't know each other, but they worked at the same place. And in 1996, another year later, the case was still unsolved, and to her parents, it seemed like there was no progress and nothing actually happening. They were told that the case was transferred to a director's special case, but they couldn't do anything more without the approval of their superiors, so nothing further was done regarding Sun Wei. But I am going to talk about her a little bit. She was born August 10th, 1973. She was one of Zhu Ling's roommates and also a member of the orchestra. So they were around each other quite a bit. The university told police that among the students with a close relationship to Zhu Ling, she was the only one who would have had access to thallium, a.k.a. it was her.
Yeah.
And she had access because it was an experiment for her research project.
Well, the alarm bells are going off, guys.
I know. Yeah. So on April 2nd, 1997, police brought her in for questioning and they questioned her continuously for 8 hours. And this was the only time that she was brought in for questioning. The university refused to give her her diploma on graduation day, and they also refused to provide a document that she needed to obtain a passport, which is interesting because I am going to get into some stuff that the university is kind of shady to Zhu Ling, but we'll get there. So it's believed that she since changed her name to Sun Xian instead of Sun Wei. And there's also a common rumor that before her grandfather, Sun Yuki, died in 1995, he made a final petition to Chairman Zhang Zemin, who they were close with, he was a close friend, to release Sun Wei from further investigation, meaning, can you please let the police leave her alone? Like, don't question her anymore. It wasn't her. Leave her be. That is just a rumor. There's no proof of that. And Sun Wei wrote in her book, Sun Wei's Manifesto, that she published in 2005, and countered this rumor by saying that police hadn't gone to investigate her until 1997 after her grandfather had already been dead. So she was like, how would he have done that if he's already dead? Well, girl, he did it before he died. So after the first theft, they decided to store Zhu Ling's belongings in the chemistry department in an office. But what's interesting is that her family did not want that to happen. They wanted her to retain her student status because as long as she was a student, the school was paying her medical bills. But they refused to do so. They said she's more than welcome to come back, but as of now, she has alumni status. But they wanted her to retain her student status so that her room could stay the same, so everything could be as preserved as possible. But instead, they removed all her belongings and kept it in the chemistry department. And eventually, it was reported to her parents that all of those items were stolen. So there's a second theft.
All of them.
And in this instance, basically all evidence is gone because that was the rest of her things. The school gave 3,000 won to Zhu's parents, which is about $420 US for the theft. Yeah. So much. So helpful. Like,
I have nothing to say. Right? I have nothing to say.
So we're getting towards the end. We're now talking about in 2006, the police revealed to the media that they had a possible suspect but didn't release who it was or why they took so long to make this information public. The suspect was Sun Wei, but they didn't tell them that. That was the only suspect that they ever had. Tsinghua University covered all her medical expenses until 1996 when she was still in rehab. The school stopped paying. And her uncle tried to meet with some of her classmates to try and kind of do their own investigation because the police weren't doing enough. And he met with six of them, but a professor prevented him from meeting more. But him and Zhu Ling's mother went to lunch with these students, and she was expecting them to be sympathetic, but instead they were basically silent and didn't eat very much. Like, they just did not want to talk about it. It was weird. It was as if they were told not to. And apparently, these students told Sun Wei about their lunch, and her family decided that they were scared for her safety, so she returned home from school. Like, I guess they were scared her uncle was going to get her. Like, I don't know. Even though no threats were made.
Yeah.
Both Zhu Ling's mother and uncle had written letters to her classmates, including those six, seeking their help to resolve the case, and those letters never got to those students. Years later, a few classmates were visiting her in the hospital, and they had no idea that these letters were ever written, and they had no idea that The poisoning was a criminal case. They didn't know that there was foul play suspected. So the university was keeping it quiet. So now we're going to get into her condition a little bit. Her eyesight, mental capacity, senses, and lower body were permanently damaged. She couldn't talk, and her lower body was paralyzed. So she required 24-hour care from then on for the rest of her life. She would need 24-hour care. And her parents reported that at least once a year after the poisoning, she was hospitalized. And in 2011, she got the flu and spent 10 months in the hospital. And after that, she could only eat liquid food from then on. On November 18th, 2023, she started having symptoms of a brain tumor, including 102-degree fever, and fell into another coma. And on December 22nd, she died at the age of 50. And no one has been convicted of her murder.
That's just so frustrating.
I know.
It's frustrating because, like, I don't know a lot about thallium poisoning, but if they had tested for it, when she first came to the hospital, I mean, like I said, I don't know about thallium poisoning, but I would think that if they had tested for her tested for it right away and started treatment, that maybe her life could have been better afterwards.
Yeah, for sure. It's just, she was just failed. Her and her family were failed by so many people, by the university, by the doctors, by the police, by, you know, whoever did do this, obviously. And it's just, I fear that now that she died, we're really never going to know.
Yeah.
For sure who did it. Like they said, the only person it could have been was Sun Wei.
I can't believe they didn't look into that.
I know.
More. That's insane to me. Mm-hmm.
But that's my case. And it is really, really upsetting. And so frustrating. Like, I was doing my research and just getting so frustrated. It took me so long to research this because I didn't want to miss anything because there's so many different details that are so important. Mm-hmm. But that's my case. Want to get into yours?
Okay, so this episode is going to be so long.
Oopsie.
Becky was taking forever.
I had 8 pages.
So I'm going to be talking about the Tylenol murders of 1982. This took place in Chicago. I think this is fairly well known that this happened. This also changed the way that we package over-the-counter medication. So this is an important case in medication history. So
it's an important case in general.
It all began when Mary Kellerman, a 12-year-old girl from Elk Grove Village, it's like a suburb of Chicago. Mm-hmm. She told her mother and father that she had a sore throat and a runny nose, and they gave her one extra strength Tylenol capsule that they didn't know it was laced with potassium cyanide, which is highly poisonous. And Mary was dead by 7 a.m.
Oh, no.
That same day, a 27-year-old postal worker named Adam Janis of Arlington Heights died of what was initially thought to be a massive heart attack, but it turned out to be cyanide poisoning as well. Mm. His brother and sister-in-law, Stanley, who was 25, and Teresa, who was 19, rushed back to their home to be with the family, and then they both experienced headaches, which it like from crying and grieving. Yeah. They both got headaches, so they took a Tylenol from the same bottle that Adam had.
Yeah,
Stanley died that same day later, and Teresa died 2 days later. So over the next few days, three more strange deaths occurred. 35-year-old Mary McFarland, 35-year-old Paula Prince and 27-year-old Mary Weiner. All of them had taken a Tylenol shortly before they had died. So then, this is early October of 1982. Investigators had made the connection between all of these deaths and traced it back to the Tylenol, found out that they were laced with potassium cyanide. And so at the time, Tylenol was one of the best-selling, if not the best-selling, non-prescription pain relievers sold in the United States. If you don't know what Tylenol is, it's a gelatin-based capsule, and they were very popular because they were very easy to swallow, so that's what made them so popular. But unfortunately, the Tylenol that all of the victims had taken were laced with a lethal dose of cyanide. So at the time, McNeil Consumer Products, which is like a sub company of Johnson & Johnson, was manufacturing Tylenol. And to give credit where it's due, Johnson & Johnson and the subset that was manufacturing Tylenol did take a very active role in the investigation and in the media, and they issued a mass warning to, like, recall Tylenol to all stores. More than 3 million bottles of Tylenol were taken off the shelves. Tainted ones were discovered in early October in a few other grocery stores in the area, grocery stores and drug stores in the Chicago area. They were not all sold yet, which was good, but customers were also told, like, if you have recently bought Tylenol or even, like, not recently, just get rid of all of it. Yeah. Just throw it out. McNeil and Johnson & Johnson offered replacement capsules to those who turned in pills already purchased. And as for anyone with information leading to, like, who could have done this, they were offering a reward for that too. So to continue the investigation, police were very confused because it was found that the poisonings happened after they left the factory. So it wasn't like a factory worker where it would have been easier for them to be poisoned in the factory because you have all the bottles right there and, like, you can do it all at the same time.
Yeah. It also would have been easier to catch who did it if it happened there, I feel.
Yeah. So some police thought that they must have been taken off the shelves of the local grocery stores and drug stores in Chicago, and then they would have been laced with the poison and then returned to the stores and, like, put back on the shelves. Either they think that what probably happened was whoever did it went into the store, took them back to, like, their house or wherever they were lacing them with the cyanide, and then bringing them back to the stores and just putting them back up on the shelves.
That is just so crazy to do. Like, I know. Why? I mean, why in general, but that's just so much effort.
Yeah.
And also, how did nobody see them doing that?
Yeah, and it's also hard because, like, what's the motive? Because you don't know who is going to
Motive's
pick up
crazy.
That.
Motive's crazy. That's the motive.
Like, you don't know who is going to come into the store and pick up the bottle.
Right, like, what if your mom went into the store and picked up the bottle?
Well, yeah, and then even, like, the 12-year-old girl that died, you know, one of her parents picked up the bottle. It obviously, like, whoever did this, you really can't know, like, who you are going to kill in the process, because it could be a child, it could be an elderly person, it could be, like, a friend. Like, if I picked up a bottle and then you were like, hey, do you have some Tylenol? And I was like, sure.
Yeah.
You really don't know who you are going to harm. And the fact that it was in multiple stores. It wasn't even like it was a store worker who wanted to like see who bought Tylenol. So on this note, unfortunately, to this day, the perpetrator has never been caught. And there isn't really any, wasn't ever any leads, like real leads. One man, James Lewis, claimed to be the Tylenol killer and wrote a ransom letter to Johnson & Johnson demanding $1 million in exchange for stopping the poisonings. So after a pretty lengthy, back and forth of trying to find him, police and federal investigators determined that Lewis lived in New York and had no way of, was never in Chicago at the time, had no way of doing this.
I'll never get when people do stuff like that. Like, why? Like, you just want attention?
Because it's in the news so much. He wanted to be connected.
I know that there's this phrase, all press is good press, but that's not true.
It's not.
There is bad press, and that is bad press.
So, yeah, it was found that he didn't do it, and he was charged with extortion and sentenced to 20 years in prison. He was released in 1995. He had only served 13 years. So there was a couple other copycat poisonings involving Tylenol and other over-the-counter medications that started, happening in 1980s and early 1990s, but they were never as bad as the 1982 Chicago Tylenol incident.
That's just so awful. Because, it gave people this idea that no one else had done before.
Yeah, it was like,
I just can't with people. I know. That was a voice crack, but I can't. I just don't understand. The more cases that we research, the more I'm like, what is wrong with people?
I know.
What is wrong with some of these police departments? What is wrong with some of these doctors? What is wrong with people in general? Why do you want to poison random people? Mm-hmm. It just makes no sense.
Yeah, I know. So then going into a little bit how this changed how we package medication before this happened. Oh, sorry. I'm going to talk about Tylenol for a second and then get into
this how checks packaging crazy. Changed.
Before the 1982 crisis, Tylenol controlled more than 35% of the over-the-counter pain reliever market. And only a few weeks after the murders, that it plummeted to less than 8%.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
I know. So that kind of...
I mean, it's not surprising, but...
Yeah, that, really hurt the company.
I'm an Advil girl.
But so Johnson & Johnson, like I said, they were very helpful in the investigation. That's and good. In the media, were like, please, everyone, throw out your Tylenol. We will give you replacements. We will pay you if you have any information about this. They also developed a new product protection method, and they pledged to do better in protecting their consumers in the future. They worked with FDA officials as they introduced a new tamper-proof packaging, which included a foil seal and other features that made it obvious to a consumer if foul play happened. So those foil seals that are on your medicines today wouldn't have been there if this didn't happen.
You know what's interesting, though? It protects it from this same situation happening, but I feel like it doesn't really protect a factory worker from doing it. You know what I mean? Because that's before packaging. I mean, you can't really, I don't know what else you would be able to do. It's just.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's still better.
Yeah. Shortly after, these packaging protections soon became the industry standard for all over-the-counter medications. Mm-hmm. The company also, Johnson & Johnson, the company also introduced price reduction and a new version of the pill called the Caplet. And it was a tablet coated with a slick, easy-to-swallow gelatin, but far harder to tamper with than the older capsules, which could have been easily opened, laced with whatever, and then placed back in the non-tamper-proof bottle. Within a year after the murders and the investigation, that they poured over $100 million into, like, the recall wow. and the changing of the package. Mm-hmm. Within a year, Tylenol sales went back to where they had been before. So well, they kind good. Of, they rebounded, like, pretty fast.
Yeah.
So then in 1983, the U.S. Congress passed what is called the Tylenol Bill, making it a federal offense to tamper with consumer products. And in 1989, the FDA established federal guidelines for manufacturers to make all such products tamper-proof. So yeah, that's kind of all I have for that. Unfortunately, all of the deaths that occurred, there was nothing that they could do about that, and no one was ever convicted. At least change came out of
yeah, it. That's the one good thing. Well.
I know. There's like...
It's just two very, very, very unfortunate cases that will probably never be solved, which sucks.
Yeah. They both happened so long ago, and...
Yeah. It's weird that it doesn't feel like it should be that long ago, but it wasn't mine was ago, 30 years was. Ago.
Yeah.
Yours was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's older than us.
Yeah.
But thank you for listening.
Thank you for watching. I can say watching now.
Yeah, no, you can pretend you're not messing up when you say it.
Okay.
If you are just listening, make sure to check out our YouTube shorts or our Instagram reels or our TikToks.
Yeah.
Our Instagram is behind_thecrime, and our Facebook is just behind the crime. Also, if you came here from our YouTube shorts, welcome.
Yeah, welcome. That's crazy.
I know. and if you haven't checked them out yet, be sure to. There should be one out prior to the episode, one releasing the same day as the episode, and one next week. So thank you guys for listening.
And watching.
And we will see you in 2 weeks. Bye.